Yeah, today. High up. Look at that. We're starting to get there. Good. Isn't that a great time? I mean, now that the rain has stopped, the roads aren't quite as muddy, we can get out there and really start enjoying ourselves, walking, get that fresh air. How many drank their water before breakfast this morning? High up. Let's see. High water before breakfast. If you haven't got it, that was our lesson yesterday. We want to practice these things as soon. That's the reason why we run a guest house, believe it or not. I had a lady phone me up, and she said, well, what do you do at the guest house? And I said, well, look out your window. And she said, well, so I can see my yard. I said, is your window dirty? And she says, well, it does need to be washed. I said, well, you can't wash our windows. In other words, we spoil you. You come to the guest house and we relax you. But at the same time, each time we present a class, we give the person an opportunity to practice that class. So eventually that lifestyle becomes instilled in them. They spend 12 days with us every day for 12 days, drinking water before breakfast, eating at the same time, eating good food, getting relaxation, getting massages. By the end of that 12 days, they've started to adopt a new routine, a new lifestyle. They've seen the value of that lifestyle change. And that's really what it takes. You know, we are busy people. We sometimes make ourselves New Year's resolutions, and we make a few changes, and we make a good start. Then we get distracted. People come to visit. We get called away. We do different things. And then we kind of fall off. And then we try again. But if you get 12 days to actually do it every day, eventually it becomes ingrained. It gets stuck. And that's what we're really after. All right. Well, what was the very first health lesson you learned when you went to school? Anyone? What was the very first health lesson? Wash your hands. Good. Anybody else? First health lesson. Brush your teeth. Good. That was another one. We have one here this morning. We were probably taught, we don't remember it maybe, but we were taught this one, and that was to how to stand up straight. Did you ever get that? The first thing that a teacher should teach you was to stand up and sit up straight. What was the reason for that? What was the main reason why they taught us to sit up and stand up straight? When I went to school, I don't even want to tell you how long ago that was, but anyway, it was... Right, most of my teachers had done a tour of duty in the military. And so they came back from the military, and their shoulders were back, and chests were out, and they walked around the classroom, you know, and I thought that was why we had to sit up straight, just because they had been in the military, and so there was kind of a carryover effect, and every once in a while they would impress it upon our minds with a stick or a pointer, a yardstick coming down on a tabletop. They go, whack, and they'd say, sit up straight, and the whole class would, ugh, we sit up there like this. What was the reason for it, though? Yeah, have you got any idea? Why sit-ups? Why sit up straight and stand up tall and all that? Why is that? What's the reason for that? For the lungs. Now, that's what we're going to get to, but there's another reason. I had a doctor of physical therapy. He told me that 90% of all neck problems are posture problems. 90% of all neck problems are posture problems. In other words, he says what happens is we may have an injury, we may have something that happens to us, some kind of a problem, but what really is going on is that we, because of it, we begin to hold our head in an unnatural position. And he says, in our culture, we walk around with our face sticking out. See, we're watching in the computer screen. You see, why won't it come on? What's wrong? Why did it just go dead? Now, we're looking at a computer screen, a lot of us. Or we're looking at a video or DVD or Blu-ray or whatever, and we're looking at that. Or we're watching the neighbors, you know. Okay. And what happens is, he says, is our faith is sticking out, which puts an unnatural tension on the back of your neck. What he said is that at rest, like you are right now, sitting in a bench or a chair, your earlobe should dissect your shoulder. In other words, your head should be far enough back on your shoulders that your earlobe cuts the middle of your shoulder. Now, it's really hard to check yourself. You have to be very quick to get your head around, quick enough to get your own ear. You can't do it. You have somebody else look at you. But if your head tends to droop, you know, when you're walking, are you the kind of person that's looking for money? You know, maybe there's some money. Maybe somebody dropped their offering. I should keep my head down, start looking. I mean, are you the kind of person that looks down when you're walking, or you got your head up? And if your head tends to bob forward and lean forward, that's putting that tension. Now, how are you going to fix that? Well, here's what he explained to me. And I'm going to show you. I'll do it here on the stage. It's a simple exercise, just like this. So you go down on your knees. You put your arms the width of your shoulders, and you do this. Now, you'll see that I didn't go on my toes. That's called a military push-up. What I did is a kind of an abbreviated portion of that. You're on your knees and you go down to your nose with your, you know, just face forward. It's very easy. There is no one, I don't think there's anyone in this room that can't do it. The problem is it's too easy. I've had guests, I've showed them that exercise, and they go up to their room and they try it. Oh, I can do one. Well, I can do two. Well, I can do six. They do 50. And they come up to breakfast the next morning, they're like this, you know. See, if you haven't done an exercise, even if it's easy, don't start with 50. Start with 5. Start with 6, something like that. And the next day, do 7. Build your body up gradually, carefully. You know, we can't just, I like what Dr. Kellogg used to say, the body gets well one cell at a time. You know, we try to jump into wellness. I have not been looking after myself at all for a long time. Now all of a sudden, I'm going to get well tomorrow. Boom. You know, everything's going to change. Bang. And we try to push ourselves a little too hard. Take it easy. But you can do those simple push-ups. And what will happen is you'll start developing these muscles right here, the trapezius muscles, and you'll be able to hold your head up. Oh, boy, you can stand up straight. And you'll find it comfortable to sit up and stand up straight. Now, the next reason is that it helps your lungs. And let's talk about that for a minute here, because that's the next important reason for standing up straight. The lungs should be allowed the greatest freedom possible. Their capacity is developed by free action and is diminished if they are cramped and compressed. Hence the ill effects of the practice so common, especially in sedentary pursuits of stooping at one's work. In this position, it is impossible to breathe deeply. Superficial breathing soon becomes a habit, and the lungs lose their power to expand. Now, what is sedentary work? What is sedentary work? We don't. Yeah, how many of you used it this last year? How many used the word sedentary? Nobody. So we have to kind of qualify. What is sedentary work? What does it mean, sedentary? It's the work we all do. No, I mean, I'm kidding. It's basically sitting, right? It's not moving much, and most of it's a computer. I part of the thing we do at Silver Hills in the wintertime, we aren't as busy, and so I go and help a company in Vancouver do some remodeling. I was remodeling their office and built the boss wanted his office a little 2 feet higher so you could see everybody at work, and so I built his office up, and I was sitting there, and I was actually looking to see if it was really effective. Could I see everybody working? And sure enough, I could see everybody at their desk working. And everybody, the moment I looked at them, including the girl who was doing the reception at the front desk, everyone was looking at a computer. If you had have told those salesmen that all of them would be looking at a computer 10 years ago, they would have said, no way. I'll be using a book. I'll never use a computer. Now they're all using a computer. That's what we call sedentary work. And in this position, what happens? We tend to stoop. We tend to roll our shoulders. We tend to compress the chest cavity. And we tend to breathe superficially. We do what's called superficial breathing. Does that make any difference? Does it make any difference? Does it matter whether you do superficial breathing or deep breathing or use your whole capacity of your lung or just a portion of your capacity? If you do superficial breathing, what part of the lung gets oxygen? Just at the top, right? Just up at the top. If the heart pushes the blood out to the lung, what part of the lung gets the blood? Do you remember we talked about this is the very first class. Once we get these classes ingrained in our minds, we begin to understand the foundation principles of health. When the heart pushes out the blood, what portion of the body is supposed to get the blood? What part of it? All of it, right? So when the heart pushes the blood out to the lung, what part of the lung gets the blood? All of it. That's what the heart does. It pushes the, why does it send the blood to the lung? What's it looking for? Oxygen, right? It needs oxygen. If you're breathing superficially then, where does the oxygen go? To the top portion. The blood goes to the whole lung, but this part of the blood did not get oxygenated, right? So it goes back to the heart. The heart pumps it out to your muscles. Your muscles are saying, well, thank you very much. I appreciate the blood, but it didn't have oxygen in it. Please send me some oxygen. Sends it back to the heart. Heart pushes it out to the lung. Supposing it goes to the bottom portion of the lung again where there's no oxygen. And then it pushes it again out to the muscle. And the muscle's saying, you know what? This is getting a little exasperating. What I really need is oxygen. What's this person going to start doing when they're exercising? Under very little exercise, they're going to be going, Because they're using a very small portion of their lung to try and oxygenate their tissue. You see what I'm saying? So that person, when they get to the top of the stairs, they're hanging onto the railing and they're going, let me catch my breath. You see what I'm saying? Because if I'm only using a small portion of my lung to oxygenate my blood, that's called superficial breathing. If that's what's happening, what organ of the body is going to be affected the most by that? The heart. Right? It's going to have to work harder and harder and harder and harder because it's pushing blood to the lung that's not getting oxygenated. It's just having to work. It's a very small percentage. So as soon as I start breathing deeply and breathing properly, one of the first things that's affected by that is my heart. If a person has a heart attack, what do they put on their, what kind of a device do they put on their face? An oxygen mask. Why? Because that relieves the heart immediately. One of the major jobs that the heart is doing is oxygenating the blood. And if you give oxygen immediately to that person, that relieves their heart. So breathing properly, sitting up straight and using your capacity of your lungs actually helps your heart. All right, that's number one. Number two, Dr. Wilhelm Huber, a German scientist, you know, he took a look at the brain and he says, you know, if you take a brain cell and you put it under a microscope, and you take a muscle cell or another one of your tissue cells and look under a microscope, they both have nucleuses, they both have cytoplasms, they look similar. Why don't the brain cells multiply? I mean, every other cell of your body multiplies, right? You keep on making new arms and legs, I mean, not overnight, but you do it over a period of years. You keep on replacing those cells and refurbishing them, but not your brain cells. Now, somebody's going to sit there and say, well, I was reading Scientific American, and sure enough, you do make new brain cells. And now they have found in your brain, you have stem cells. They've only found them in one location. That's in the hippocampus area. The hippocampus is the area of your brain that has to do with memory. Guess what they have discovered is the only way that those cells make new cells. There's only one way. They've only found one way they'll do it. Do you know what it is? Guess what it is. How many want 50%? Help me out. What is the word? Exercise. There you go. You got it. The only thing that they've found out that makes you lay down new memory cells is exercise. That's the only thing. Isn't that amazing? And that's in the hippocampus area. But as far as the rest of our brain goes, most of us in this room realize that we just don't get new brain cells. We have what we have. Now, what Dr. Huber said, they have every capability of making new cells, so let's try it. He took brain cells from rats' brains. He put them in petri dishes. He gave them the right nutrients. He stimulated them. He gave them oxygen to breathe, and he was able to multiply those cells. And when he got them a new clump of cells, he took and grafted them back in the rat's brain, and the rat had now got more brain cells. He was a brainier rat. It didn't mean that they actually worked for him, because having more cells doesn't help. We all know that. You have to actually get them to integrate with each other and relate to each other and send signals and be specialized and everything like that. But at least he proved that you could do it. Well, the implications are fabulous. Think of it. If a person had a stroke, if a person had a brain injury, if a person had a tumor, if there was some kind of a birth defect, if you could take the person's brain cells and actually multiply them and graft them back into their own brain, that's fabulous. In his experiments, he discovered something. Sometimes the rat's brain cells that he had in the petri dishes did not make exact copies, did not make exact replicas of the parent cell. They mutated. When he took those mutant cells and he grafted them back into the rat's brain, what do you think happened? What do you think they formed? They formed a tumor. I mean, this is what a tumor is. A tumor is cells no longer are replicating the parent cell. They've mutated, right? They're mutant cells, and they've just started multiplying according to their new mutation. And so what he discovered was all it took was to reduce the amount of oxygen flowing to the cells when they were dividing for them to mutate. All it had to happen is reduce the amount of oxygen going to the cells, and then they would mutate. Now, okay, so what the question then we have to ask ourselves, what are some habits that we have in Canada, lifestyle habits that we have that will reduce the amount of oxygen going to our tissue? Number one, health habit in Canada, maybe nobody in this room does it, but what's the number one health habit that reduces oxygen to our tissue? What is it? Smoking. Good. Well, What kind of tumor, what kind of cancer do you get from smoking? Lung cancer, right? But doesn't smoking reduce the oxygen to all of your tissue? Not just your lungs. Do you know that being a smoker puts you at the top of every list of cancer in Canada? Breast, bowel, prostate, every skin, doesn't matter what cancer there is, being a smoker puts you at the top of every one of those lists. Because it reduces what? The amount of oxygen. What would be another health habit that we could be involved in that would reduce the amount of oxygen flowing to our tissue? Anything else? A high fat diet. What fat does is it coats those little red blood cells. You remember I told you that this is, you know, it's hard. I have at home, I have a blackboard, and I can scribble on the blackboard, and it helps to make a picture, but it will make a picture in your mind. Remember I told you the red blood cells have electrical charges on their surfaces that repel each other? And what happens when the fat coats those little red blood cells, they don't repel each other. They get chummy, they begin to hang together, and they form little chains called rouleau, and they actually start to agglutinate or stick together. And when they get into that, remember I told you they have to actually fold to get into the capillary? Well, one folds with another one hooked to them, and they both can't get in there, and they sit there, and they block off that capillary. And the cells, if they're in that capillary, they suffer from what's called hypoxia, which means that they can't multiply exact copies. Are you with me? And what's that? What's causing that? They can take and set a microscope up on your eye, and they can look at those little blood vessels, you know, right up at the surface of your eye. You know how you can rub them, they'll get red sometimes. They can look down in those little blood vessels, and they can count the amount of clumping that you have going on in there, and they can tell you how much cream you had and how long ago you ate it by how much clumping you have. Isn't that amazing? Because it takes a period of time for your body to break that clumping back down again. And so they can actually tell you. We can actually trigger, you know, we have people that come to the guest house that have angina. This is a chest pain. The heart muscle is not getting enough oxygen, and so it starts to get into pain. It starts having pain, chest pain. We call it angina. They can actually create angina by feeding a person just a high-fat diet, a really high fatty meal. You know, give them a big, juicy, fatty meal with some ice cream at the end of it, and they can actually bring on an angina attack without any exercise, just with fat. Because it reduces the amount of oxygen flowing through the tissue. Are you with me? So high fat. Okay, what's the next one? We've got smoking, high fat. Help me out. Who wants 50%? A lack of exercise, of course. Exercise is an oxygen pump. When you are out exercising, you're moving your muscles, and your muscles are sending a signal to your lungs saying, I need oxygen. I need to your heart, actually. I need oxygen. I need oxygen. We create an oxygen debt by exercise. And so we start going, and we start getting oxygen. Exercise is an oxygen pump. It's what pumps oxygen into the tissue. And a lack of exercise means that I'm getting very little oxygen. I can sit there and I can look at the computer and I can do Facebook and I can watch a movie and I can be barely breathing and I can have the window shut in the room I'm in and I can be just sitting there just barely existing. You see, and very little oxygen going to the tissue. So these are the three things. If you went to the Canadian Cancer Society and you asked them for the three lifestyle habits common in Canada that could predispose a person to cancer, you know what they will give you. The three things they will give you are smoking, high-fat diet, and a lack of exercise. And all of them are the same thing, meaning a lack of oxygen. Now, interestingly enough, there are people who have tried what we would call creative ideas in tackling the cancer problem. Some of them will go to Mexico. And they will use things like, how many of you have heard of this? Hydrogen peroxide. Have you ever heard of people using hydrogen peroxide intravenously? Hydrogen peroxide, when it hits the bloodstream, becomes oxygen. Have you heard of people using ozone? Ozone suppositories, ozone creams, ozone tablets, ozone drops, oxygen 3. Have you heard of people doing hyperbaric oxygen chambers? They go into a hyperbaric oxygen chamber where they increase the atmospheric pressure and then they pump in purified oxygen. All of these, what we would say created, they take vast amounts of herbs to clean the blood so their blood can carry more oxygen. Are you with me? Are you ready to sit up straight now and breathe properly? There you go. You see the value of it? Now I'm going to give you the next thought. Here you go. This goes right along its heels. the part we may have missed when we went to school, and this is what we should have been getting. Whoops, I just missed the text part. Here we go. The one who sits and stands erect is more likely than others to breathe properly, but the teacher should impress upon his pupils the importance of doing what? Deep breathing. How many of you got that lesson when you went to school? Some of you that were singers did. I didn't. The thing I got when the teacher brought down the pointer or yardstick on the table and told me to sit up straight, it was so scary I held my breath for the next 10 minutes. Afraid to move. But the teacher should impress upon the pupils the importance of doing what? Deep breathing. What does that look like? That's exactly what we want. Well, first of all, before we get into what it looks like, I want to talk to you what deep breathing does for you. The healthy action of the respiratory organs assisting the circulation of the blood. How does the healthy action of your lungs assist your circulation? Now, the foundation principle we gave you at the very first class was perfect circulation is perfect health. The next one we gave you was the importance of cleansing. Now we're showing you the importance of oxygenation or metabolism. And it says here, the healthy action of your lungs assisting the circulation of your blood. How does that happen? Who's wanted to jump forward and give me the answer on that one? How does the healthy action of your lungs assist your circulation? Well, you remember I told you if you used your whole lung, what organ of the body is going to appreciate that the most? If you use your whole lung, what organ is going to get the best benefit of it? Your what? Your heart. So the healthy action of your lung assisting your heart. That's another way of saying it, right? Then the next thing it says, assisting the circulation of the blood, it says it invigorates the whole system. Now, I get a kick out of this. You know, when I go out and lecture, I go all over the place lecturing to different people. And people come up to me and they ask me for a brochure, and then they sign up online, and they're going to come as health guests. And I think I have to hand it to them, they got to be very brave people to come to a health guest house for 12 days. I wonder if they can really trust me for 12 days to feed them in a way that they can appreciate it. You know what I mean? I gotta sit where you are and think, would I sign up to go to a guest house for 12 days? I actually have guests that pack their suitcases. I had one guy who was carrying a suitcase out. I set it down on the way out, and out of it fell a Toblerone chocolate bar. You know, bang. He came prepared. I said to him, well, at least you didn't have to eat that while you were here, did you? People love the food, but people got to be brave, you know, to come there. Because food is important, right? We don't want to get to a place where there's thin soup and tasteless food. And, oh, boy, what is it going to be like, right? We want to have something that we enjoy. So but you know, food is not that big a deal when it comes to health. I know we make a big deal about it, but when you think of it, you eat your food and you swallow it, it really doesn't do that much. It may fill your stomach up, may taste good, but it goes down into your stomach. It has to be digested before it does anything, and it's digested, and your body absorbs the nutrients, and it travels through your bloodstream, and it gets to your cells, and the cells absorb it, and still nothing's happened. But when it comes in contact with oxygen, that's when everything happens. That's when everything turns on. That's what makes the system go, is the oxygen. In BC, British Columbia, where we're from, we use a lot of wood for heat. We aren't blessed with oil and gas like you guys. We use wood. We're still back in the dark ages. And we pride ourselves in the kind of wood we have. Oh, there's guys that cut birch, nothing but birch, and they stack it up, and you look at their fence line, they've got it dried for 2 years, and it was aged, and it was perfect, and there's guys that will only burn fir, and they've got nice stacks of fir, and other guys swear on tamarack, you got to burn tamarack, and you got to have it 2 years seasoned, and all that. Oh boy, we're proud of our wood. You put the wood in your wood stove, you get that stove really cooking, get that fire burning, and you shut off the air, what happens? I don't care whether it's birch or fir or poplar or tamarack. I don't care what it is. If you shut off the air, how much heat do you get out of that stove? Nothing. And that's exactly the way it is with your food. It doesn't matter what you put in your stomach and you digest. I don't care how valuable it is. If you do not have oxygen, if you're not oxygenating that food, you do not have that word that's called vigor. You do not have the vigor. Are you with me? You don't have that energy. You don't remember I told you earlier that if we're not exercising, we're craving. We don't have energy because energy is produced when food comes in contact with oxygen. Oxygen is the thing that makes it happen. All right? Okay. So it says here, assisting the circulation of the blood invigorates the whole system, and I wish the next one wasn't there. It says it excites the appetite. I often wonder, do we really need that? Well, let me explain it to you, because sometimes we miss the point here because we're thinking this way when we could be thinking that way. Most of us in this room were raised in Canada as kids, and so we had to entertain ourselves in the wintertime. Some of you went skiing. Some of you went skating. Some of you went and snowmobiling. We did something. We went out in the wintertime and did something. For me, it was skating. Right across from our family home was the community skating rink that we would have to, you know, irrigate with water with a hose. We had to make it. And we played hockey. Oh, my brother and I, and those days they only had 6 hockey teams. And we knew all of the hockey players by name. You know, John Beliveau and Henri Richard and Pocket Richard and Eddie Shack and John Beliveau. We knew them all. We knew all of their numbers and their names and everything like that. And so we would go out on Sunday morning at crack of dawn with a T-shirt on of the man of our choice. And we would go out and play hockey until our feet froze. And we'd go and stand by the heater and cry while our feet warmed up. And then we'd go out and skate again until they froze again. We did that all day Sunday. Oh, we were crazy. Sunday night, we come home, and Mom would say, I'm so sorry, guys. You know what? I was doing laundry all day today, and all I got is beans for supper. What do you think we said? Mom, you don't even have to open the can. Just give us the can opener. We'll eat it right out of the can. We could eat the leg off a horse. We could eat anything. We didn't care what it was. We could eat it. It didn't matter, right? We didn't even have to have butter on the bread. Just give us the bread and beans cold. We'll eat it. We would eat anything. That's what I call what? An excited appetite. That's what oxygen does for you. Now we get a little older. We got what we call Sunday afternoon football. See, we got the Rose Bowl and the Cactus Bowl and the, you know, the Sugar Bowl and the Popcorn Bowl and, you know, all those bowls. You know, we had all of them. We're sitting all afternoon. Sunday evening, Mom comes to us. You know what? All I got is beans for supper. What do we say? Oh, Mom, can't we order a pizza? Can't we get something to stimulate our appetite? If we are not well oxygenated, we need something to stimulate our appetite from the outside. But if we are well oxygenated, well exercised, well, see, we simple plain food is just exciting. Your appetite is excited. Are you with me? See the difference? Okay. So deep breathing excites the appetite. Then it says it promotes. How does breathing promote digestion? See, you have 30 feet of digestive tract. We have a whole class. We don't have time while we're here this camp meeting to talk to you about it, but we have a whole class called The Physiology of Digestion, explaining people how their digestion works. But we have one of the most complex digestive systems for our size of any creature out there. If we took our size and multiplied us to the size of a horse, we would have twice as big a digestive tract as he has. Isn't that amazing? That's how complex. And we have a 30-foot-long digestive tract, and the food moves in that pipe. How does it move? Does anybody know how it moves? It's called peristalsis. It's actual muscle contractions. What makes those contractions? What makes those muscles contract? Do you know if they cut the brain nerves off from your brain to your intestine, it'll still do it? Isn't that amazing? You produce more serotonin. You have a brain in your gut. You produce more serotonin. You produce 90% of your serotonin is produced in your gut. This is what we call a neurotransmitter, but it actually is in your gut. You have a brain in your gut for running your digestive tract, and that peristalsis is triggered by the contents, so that whatever's in your gut touching the wall, it triggers the gut to move it. Can you imagine Philadelphia cream cheese, you know? I know you're in there, but where are you? You know, like, I don't feel nothing. You know, like, it's nice to have fiber. You with me? See what the difference, how fiber helps? Now, have you ever, don't have to give me a show of hands, have you ever been to a potluck or a Thanksgiving dinner or Christmas dinner or something like that? Yeah, you know, it was so good. You had the third plate. You were just about finished, and somebody came along and asked you if you had their cabbage rolls. No, I haven't. Well, you better have a few of them. You have a few of them. Did you have my pierogies? No, I didn't have them. Well, you better have a few of them. And how about my jello salad? Oh, well, I better have a bit of that. And pretty soon you feel like your gut is so full, nothing's moving. Have you ever had that feeling? Like it's just stopped. It's all like it's just uncomfortable. Like You wish you could find a hand railing. You know, you could just find a hand railing and kind of lean over it, right, and kind of bump your stomach against it to get it going again. Dr. Kellogg actually invented a machine that you could strap around your back and that would actually knead your intestines so that it would keep that peristalsis going while you're eating. Now, we would think here that's not necessary, but if you have worked with enough sick people, sickness causes stress. It causes pain, and it also causes stress because you're not capable of doing the things you once did. You're not capable of doing the same work you once did, and so you're stressed. And the first thing that stress hits is your digestive tract. I've had people that have come to the guest house, and they take one bite of food, and their stomach just bloats right away. Blah. They don't feel like eating. It's just like, I don't want to eat. And so he invented a machine for some of his people that were like that, that would knead the intestine to keep the intestines working. We had a doctor that told us that if you have a person like that, take them out after lunch and get them walking and keep them walking until the digestion starts up. And so it does take a bit of time, but it will actually start up. But deep breathing, what deep breathing does is it involves the diaphragm, and when the diaphragm drops, see, it bumps against the digestive tract. When it drops again, it bumps against the digestive tract, and before you know it, it starts that peristalsis up again. See how it's going? So deep breathing actually massages your digestive tract and helps your digestion. All right? So another reason for doing our deep breathing. Works great at potlucks. Okay, here we go. All right, then the next one, it says that deep breathing does what? Soothing and... No. Induces sound sweet sleep. Deep breathing induces sound sweet sleep. Now, I have to tell you, when I first learned this myself, I was in Alabama. And the doctor who was teaching it to us was teaching in the afternoon. I was sharing a holiday trailer with another fellow. They supplied us breakfast and lunch. It was up to us to get supper. We were both bachelors. We had no cooking facilities. We were in Alabama. They had great big watermelons for sale, and so we would buy a watermelon for supper, cut it in half, he'd eat half, I'd eat half, and every night that's how we had our supper. You know what we did all night? You got any idea what we did all night long? Anyway, we were in a holiday trailer, so the door went bang when he went out, and then bang when I would go out, and then a few minutes later, bang when he would go out. All night long, we were going outside. And there we are sitting in this hall listening to a lecture on health. The temperature of the hall was at least 90, 95. There was no air conditioning. And we had been up all night with our watermelon and getting rid of it. And then this doctor was talking to us about deep breathing inducing sound sweet sleep. Now, you have to imagine us sitting in that classroom in that afternoon after lunch. We did not have to have sound sweet sleep induced in us. We were fighting to stay awake everything possible. And I did not think this class was that important. But it has become the most important health class I had. And let me explain that to you. This is very, very important. Sound sweet sleep is what it induces. When we came home, we decided that we wanted to build a lifestyle center like we had seen. We saw something. I saw people going and walking with doctors on nature trails and learning how to cook differently, and I saw them changing their lifestyle, and I said, that's what we need here in Canada. We need to build one. And we started a committee. How many of you have sat on a committee? No one here has sat on a committee. One, two people, more than that, three, four. When you sit on a committee, what do you discuss? Problems. That's what committees are for, solving problems. I'm a kid. I'm a youngster, 25 years of age, 26. I'm going to go to the committee with, I'm not going to go empty-handed. I'm going to take five problems when I go. I can certainly see five things that need fixing on this place. There's five guys on the committee. All five guys bring five things. When I went home, I had 25 things that needed to be fixed. We were working 14 hours a day. We were exhausted. I would go to bed totally exhausted. Here comes a problem. Yero bong. Oh, no. Here comes another problem. Yero bong. Oh, here comes another problem. I can't sleep. Have you ever had that? I don't think there's a worse torture. There's no worse torture than if you're tired, exhausted, and you can't sleep. I can't sleep. I can remember I was finally so frustrated one night after committee. I'm laying there. I can't sleep. I'm dodging problems. I'm ducking them. I'm rolling around in bed. Finally, I figured I'm going to wake up my wife. I just got out of bed. What do you think happened? Immediately, as soon as I got out of bed. My wife woke up. What are you doing? I said, I can't sleep. Well, she said, get in bed. I said, well, I was just in bed, honey. I thought if I stood up long enough, I'd get tired enough, I'd fall over and go to sleep. Are you going to jump? I'm not going to jump. I'm only on the second floor. I'd break my leg. I'd have to get up on the roof to hurt myself. I could see she was frustrated. So I got back in bed. What do you think happened then? She went right back to sleep. Right, boom. Now I can't sleep and I can't get out of bed. Here comes another problem. Boom. Then I remembered what that doctor said. Breathe in through your nose. Count to 20. Once your lungs are full, count to 20. Purse your lips and blow it all out. Breathe in through your nose. Purse your lips. Count to 20. You say, purse your lips and blow it all out. Do that 30 times. Okay, so here I am, laying on my back. Okay, the problems are still roaming around there, but I'm going to try this. So here I go. And I breathe in through my... I made a few noises. You know, when you first start this, you think you got it, but I didn't. I was trying to relax and do it all right and everything, counting and all the rest of it. And I made a few squeaks and stuff, and I figured I'd wake my wife up. But I finally got it going. Nice rhythm. Okay, now I can start counting. I did my deep breathing. I counted five on one hand, and I counted five on the other hand, and immediately, you know what happened? I said, how am I going to remember where I started? I got to remember how many... I'm starting to think about I got 10. How am I going to get to 30? I could do another set of 10, another set of 10, but I may forget how many sets of 10 I've done because I'm still counting to 20 each time, so I got to have another method of storing up numbers. What am I going to do? I got to 12 while I was still thinking about it and fell asleep. Wow. I said, this is fantastic. I wonder how many problems or what type of a problem would be too difficult to deep breathe my way through. Let me just go to committee meeting. Now, going to committee meeting was kind of exciting because I wanted to see how difficult the problem could be that would keep me awake that I couldn't deep breathe my way through. It says it does what? Induces sound, sweet sleep. Soothing and tranquilizing the mind. Deep breathing does this. It induces sound, sweet sleep, soothing and tranquilizing. Your brain is an oxygen hog. It requires five times more oxygen than any other tissue for its weight. If you do deep breathing, if you get well oxygenated, the thing that receives the best benefit from it is your brain. The thing that relaxes the most is your nervous system. If you start deep breathing, the thing that relaxes, when you come back from exercise, you notice how you sit down and you kind of relax. Well, what you're getting is the benefit of this oxygenation that's gotten into your whole nervous system, and your whole nervous system relaxes. And so you can do that with just simply doing deep breathing when you can't fall asleep. Well, how do we do deep breathing? You know, I've given this lecture to a grade 5 class of boys. I line them up, 6 or 7 of them in a row, and I tell them, give me your deepest breath. You know what they do? They go like this. And I wonder, you know, why they, first of all, like without any prompting, why did they go up on their toes? They do. I don't know why. And they raise their shoulders and they stick their chest out, you know, boom, and they're all take a deep breath. But really what I want to do is I want you to start deep breathing down here. So when we take the air in, where does it go in? Where do we take the air in? Through our what? Through our nose. Why do we breathe in through our nose? Any idea? Why do you use your nose instead of your mouth? You can use your mouth if you have, but why do we use our nose? It filters the air. We got nose hairs, right? It's an updraft carburetor, and most of the big chunks fall out. You know, the dust and particles fall down, so the air goes up. You know, if your nose was the other way up, you know, rain would get in, right? People would look in. It's an updraft carburetor. And then you also have this mucus lining in there that traps the fine particles. Oh, this is really good. This traps all the fine dust particles. So it warms it, thankfully, if you live in Saskatchewan. I know you don't have the cold here, but over in Saskatchewan, that it warms the air for you, you know, and it moistens it. This is an air conditioner, so it's warmed, moistened, cleansed, prepared to go down into your lungs. You want that beautiful air getting into your lungs. In your trachea, you have these tiny little hairs called cilia lining the trachea. And if you want those little hairs to stick out and do their job just vroom, like that, you go for a walk in the morning underneath the trees. You know, trees breathe out oxygen. And the coolness of the day and the freshness of the morning, you go for a walk. And those trees are giving off oxygen. And those little cilia just vroom, and they kick the dust out. And oh, boy, you know, you've got good, fresh air getting out of your lungs. And those alveoli want to open up and take in that air and fill that blood with oxygen, see? You go work in a building where they take the air and they run it through those filters, and you know, they keep on running it through those mechanical filters, and the air gets positive ions in it. It's similar to those Chinooks that blow through the valleys. Those positive ions, they make the little hairs droop like this, and we get what we call the sick building syndrome, where people get upper respiratory infections one right after the other because the body can't get rid of the dust and the particles and things like that because the cilia aren't working. If you want to paralyze those cilia for 2 hours, just smoke one cigarette. One cigarette will paralyze the cilia for 2 hours. So the dust particles get past the cilia and they begin to irritate the bronchial tubes. Most smokers, if they smoke for a number of years, have what we call bronchitis. They have, because the bronchial tubes become inflamed. And when they become inflamed, they cry. And they cry moisture that trickles down into the alveoli. Those are the little grape-like sacs that are inside your lung. And they fill the alveoli. The alveoli increase the capacity of the lung to 2,000 square feet because of all these little tiny sacs in your lung. It's not just one great big open sack. It goes from 2 square yards to 2,000 square feet of area to exchange oxygen with carbon dioxide. And so down the water fills those bottom alveoli. And you can hear it. You put on a stethoscope and you listen to a smoker's lungs. And you hear up here, you hear the air. You go down a little further. You go down a little further, and all of a sudden it sounds like somebody's got their hair and they're running it through their fingers. You know that crackling sound? You hear that crackling down here. That's water in the alveoli. If you were ever a smoker, I used to smoke when I was younger. When you wake up in the morning, what do you do? What do you do? Cough. How do you cough? Is that right? How do you cough? Right? You know what happens? Those alveoli can't take that kind of pressure and they break. Water is incompressible. And what happens is those alveoli, when they break, this person just went from chronic bronchitis to emphysema. That's emphysema. The alveoli are not there anymore. I do not have the capacity any longer to exchange oxygen with carbon dioxide. One of my best friends, a fellow that was in our valley, when we went down there, he was in his, probably in his 60s, late 60s, but anyway, he died when he was 74, and he had emphysema. He was a smoker, and he had emphysema, and he became a prisoner in his own body. It would take him a full 3/4 of an hour to walk from here to that back door. Literally, 3/4 of an hour. You wouldn't believe that anybody could take that long, but because of emphysema, that's what it took him. We need our lungs. So, you have no muscles in the lungs at all. The muscle that controls the lungs is your diaphragm. You have no muscle in the lungs. The lungs are just two bags in your chest. That what fills them with air is when the diaphragm drops. You create, it's just like the piston in the car when you want the oxygen and gas to go in the piston drops, it sucks that oxygen and gas into it. The piston of the body is the diaphragm. When it drops, it creates a negative pressure in the thoracic cavity and your chest cavity, and the air rushes into your lungs. Now, the trouble with most of us is if you put your hand on your stomach, try to push it out, it's hard. It's hard to get the diaphragm to drop. So the most important part of the breathing, deep breathing, is the breathing out. Because you can make it go in, you can blow out much easier than you can get it to come in. And when you blow as much air out as you can, that's why you form this muscular ring with your lips, because you're pushing against this muscle here, and as you push, your diaphragm comes up. And as soon as you stop and you start taking the air in, you fill your lungs right up. So let's practice it. Try to get all the air out. I'm going to do the counting, and let's do some breathing. We're going to do 3 deep breaths. So in through our nose. Let's go in now. Hold. Purse your lips and blow it all out. Blow it out some more. Okay, in. Hold. Purse your lips and blow it all out. In. Hold. Purse your lips and blow it all out. Okay, just breathe normally. I don't want anybody to fall asleep here. Now, quite often when I do this set of lectures, I go like on a Monday night or a Tuesday night and a Thursday night, Tuesday night and a Thursday night, so I keep going back to the same community. So that when I come back the next time, I ask the people, how did you make out with the deep breathing, you know, that type of thing. And I had a lady put up her hand in response to that question. And she said, I cannot count to 20. And the man sitting beside her just turned to her and said to her, just like this, go back to school. I got a kick out of that. She didn't mean I can't count to 20. She meant I can't make it to 20, right? She can count to 20, no problem. She just can't last to the count of 20. So what I tell people is the way you count is like when you played hide and seek when you were a kid. You remember how you played hide and seek? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. Here I come. You ready? So that's simple. If you're doing one steamboat, two steamboats, three steamboats, we may have to carry you out on a stretcher, you see? You won't make it. We're not trying to stop you from breathing. We are trying to slow your breathing down and get it to be rhythmic, you see? We're trying to get it to slow down. We don't want you to hyperventilate. We want you to count to 20, purse your lips, blow it all out, breathe in, count to 20, purse your lips, blow it all out, and keep doing that. What I'd like you to do is try that today, sometime during the day. If you do it at night, very few of you will make it to 30, guaranteed. Besides, you'll run into the same problem I have. How are you going to count those extra beats? So you're going to have a hard time with that. But during the daytime, when you're not going to go to sleep, I would like you to experience 30 deep breaths. I've had people tell me, oh, you know what, I like that idea. So I'm doing it when I'm walking, I'm doing it when I'm cooking, I'm doing it when I'm eating, I'm doing it when I'm drinking my water, I'm doing it on the phone, I'm doing it everywhere. I say, don't do that. What I want you to do is 30 deep breaths. Focus on that. Do that. Try and develop the capacity of your lung. If you try and develop the capacity of your lung today, 6 months from now, the capacity of your lung will be greater. You'll be breathing deeper. A year from now, you'll be breathing deeper than that. And in 2 years from now, you'll be breathing deeper than you were a year ago. And if you do that, you will experience all of the things that I just mentioned to you. Remember that? Invigorates the whole system, excites the appetite, induces sound, sweet sleep, encourages digestion. That will become a part of your routine. If you start deep breathing while you're eating, you may inhale food. If you do it while you're drinking, you may drown. If you do it on the phone, the other person's liable to hang up. You know what I mean? You want to deep breathe as an exercise. Are you with me? Okay. Now, so you're the person that wakes up at 4 o'clock in the morning wide awake, right? 3:30. Wow, what a fabulous time to wake up. This is creativity time. Oh, now you can plan this and you can plan that, and every plan you make is coming to fruition. You have no problem at all. The boss is always agreeable, and the husband and wife is always agreeable. Everybody's agreeable to your plans, and you can open bank accounts and close bank accounts. Oh, wow, this is perfect. Sell property, buy property. This is great. And a half an hour of that, you're doing all this problem solving. You feel like, oh, this is great. First of all, let me tell you this. Anytime I've ever done it, when I woke up at 6 o'clock in the morning, all of those plans just seemed so small. But anyway, at the time, wow. But the trouble is that at 4 o'clock or 4:15, what happens? You start getting this anxious feeling, if I don't go back to sleep, I'm going to be a wreck, right? I'm going to be awful. I got to get some sleep. That is the moment to start your deep breathing. Now, I make you a guarantee. You cannot problem solve and deep breathe, count to 20 and problem solve at the same time. Not going to happen. If you think you can, try it. It won't work. So what you have to do is you have to make up your mind. If I'm going to start deep breathing, don't go back to problem solving. Get into the deep breathing and stay with it. Now, I've had people tell me, you know what, Phil? I tried that deep breathing thing, and I did my 30 deep breaths, and I didn't fall asleep. What would you tell them? You're not going anywhere. You may as well keep it up. And guess what? If you do deep breathing, I will make anybody in this room a guarantee. If you do deep breathing from 4 o'clock in the morning until 6 o'clock, you will be more rested when you get out of bed at 6 o'clock than if you slept. And once you discover this, you will never, ever be afraid. You will look forward to waking up so you can deep breathe. Are you with me? You will look forward to that experience. And you know when that happens? You just can't stay awake. I don't know why. Once the anxiety about falling asleep is gone, and you're looking forward to doing the deep breathing, you keep on falling asleep. Because usually, for most people, it's the anxiety about the actual sleep experience that keeps you awake. Are you with me? Please, start learning how to do deep breathing. Start practicing it. Start getting into that routine, and you'll see the capacity of your lung, your ability to soothe and tranquilize your mind, the ability to rest will improve. The air we breathe then is what? More important than the food we eat. Isn't that amazing? When it comes to health, what we've talked to you about so far is circulation, right? Exercise, circulation. We talked to you about cleansing, drinking water, the simple. Now we're talking to you about what's called metabolism or oxygenation, deep breathing. All of these things are absolutely more important than food. If you're eating without exercising, if you're eating without drinking water, if you're eating without deep breathing, you're not getting the value from your food, and many times you're causing your system a lot of problems. We need these. These are the fundamentals. These are absolutely, what shall we say, primary importance, all right? In no case should sick persons be deprived of a full supply of fresh air and pleasant weather. Fresh air will prove far more beneficial to sick persons than medicine is far more essential to them than their food. They will do better and will recover sooner when deprived of food than when deprived of fresh air. Have you been in a retirement center? Not everyone, but some. You go in there and you see people that are sitting there with their head between their knees. They're exhausted. And you're sitting there after 15 minutes. What do you like? You say, oh, I wish I had some what? Air. Oh, I need air. Isn't that right? We've built buildings many times and we don't have the windows so they can open. We just keep them closed up tight. We need air. We're air-breathing creatures. We must have air. If you went to a health retreat like ours in the 1800s, you would go home with a sleeping shelf. One of the things, now we send people home with supplements and blenders and, you know, all kinds of gadgets. But then they would send you home with a sleeping shelf. What did it look like? Well, it was the length of your body. It had a leg on one end, and it came with a piece of canvas and tacks. What you were supposed to do is set the sleeping shelf on your window ledge with the one portion of it sticking out the window. You were supposed to put the canvas around the wood frame and tack it on there, and you were supposed to sleep on that sleeping shelf with your head outside your bedroom window every night until you got well. And that was what was called a sleeping shelf. In the 1800s, you go home with one. Well, we say today, we don't need it. You know, that back in those days, they had wood heat in their houses, they had coal heat in their houses, and they shared the same room as the heater, and the heater would suck all the oxygen out of the room. The room was overheated, and so, of course, they had to keep their head stuck outside. Now we got modern houses, you know, beautiful big rooms in them, and, oh, we got central heating systems, and we can lay in bed, and we can even just have skimpy pajamas on, and we're fine. See, we don't have to be like that. And I got people that sleep in their bedroom with the bedroom door shut, the window shut, and they're in there all night sleeping with their head under the covers because they're afraid of the boogeyman. They're rebreathing the same air over and over again. You know? Are you with me? Just because we have modern houses doesn't mean to say we have to have the window shut. We need to have air. We're air-breathing creatures, especially when we're sleeping. We need air. Now, I always get a kick out of this because somebody in this room is nudging their wife or their husband. That always happens. Because some guys, they like to have the window wide open and that gale force wind sifting snow across their naked body. Oh, wow, this feels fabulous. And the wife is, oh, honey, shut the window. It's so cold in here. Oh, that health guy said we needed air. Let's have lots. Well, listen, air is a gas. I don't want to get between anybody here. Air is a gas, so it can actually circulate through the room, and you can have the bedroom door open and a room window across the hall open. You don't have to have the one right over your bed blowing. I like it that way. I like cold air, fresh air right across my face. But I don't have to freeze my partner, right? I mean, I don't have to. Air is a gas. It will circulate through your room. Okay? Last thought. Here we go. I hate to end with this thought, but here it is. Here's what happens if you don't get enough oxygen. When an insufficient supply of oxygen is received, the blood moves sluggishly. The waste poisonous matter we now call carbon dioxide, which is thrown off in the exhalations from the lungs, is retained, and the blood becomes impure. Not only the lungs, but the stomach, liver, and brain are affected. The skin becomes sallow. The digestion is retarded. The heart is depressed. The brain is clouded. The thoughts are confused. Gloom settles upon the spirits. The whole system becomes depressed, inactive, and peculiarly susceptible to disease. Ugh, that's horrible. What's the problem? Not enough air. So I meet this dear person. I take them in my car to the park, walk them along the flower beds and the streams and out in the fresh air. And, oh, boy, we had such a nice time. And I take them home, and they give me a big hug. And they, oh, Phil, you're so wonderful. It wasn't me. They just needed to be aired out, right? There you go. What we need to do, please, take time sometime today. I'm going to ask you tomorrow how you made out with your deep breathing. Give it a try. Eileen, let's do it. We're going to jump into our cooking portion now.
I think I'll just deep breathe here. There you go. One whole breath.
Okay. Before Eileen gets started with the cashew rice loaf, I'm just going to go through entrees. Today we promised you we'd go over entrees for you. Interestingly enough, when we have guests that come to our guest house, they because we're changing them, moving them away from what we would call an animal-based diet, which is what we have in our society today, and we're moving them more towards a plant-based diet, one of the problems that we deal with, and we have tomorrow we will be talking to you about nutrition. We're going to go in through it. It won't be as comprehensive when the people come to the guest house because it's for them it's an introduction. It's the beginning stages. We will take quite a while. So we're going to do tomorrow night's, we do the lecture we do tomorrow for them, but then we also do one on protein, we do one on carbohydrates, we do one on fats, so we can explain each one individually. And we also do the physiology of digestion. But for them, for many people, when they move to a plant-based diet, the fear they have is they won't get enough what? Protein, exactly. That's why we do a whole lecture on protein. I'm just going to, for this group this time, I'll just introduce our entrees with this thought. Dr. John McDougall, when he was doing his lectures, and basically said that if you eat a variety of grains, fruits, and vegetables, enough calories to support your body, it is impossible not to have enough protein. All right, if you eat a variety of grains, fruits, and vegetables, it is not possible to produce a protein-poor diet. So the idea that we can't get enough protein from eating plants is kind of stuck in our minds. It's still stuck in many people's minds. And people still like to have an entree. They like to have something that looks like, you know, it takes that place of an entree. So that's what Eileen will be showing you here. And I'm going to go through what entrees we use in our cookbook. And this isn't all of them, but this is just a list of them. Cabbage rolls, cashew rice loaf, chicken roll-ups, creamy fettuccine Alfredo, egg rolls, fire hall pasta, fish sticks, Hungarian goulash, Irish stew, lasagna, lazy man's pierogies. Then we have a number of rice recipes, shepherd's pie, chili, tofu croquettes, and walnut burgers. Now, Eileen, this morning is going to be showing you, first off, she's going to show you the cashew rice loaf, which is one of the guests' favorites. It's also one of the easiest ones to make. So she's going to be showing you that, and then she's going to talk to you about meal planning and how to get variety, because really, eating the same thing over and over again, you kind of miss out. So she's going to do that. Okay, Eileen, go ahead.
Okay. One of the things we had discussed at the beginning was we wanted to try to get as much whole grains as possible. I told you that I grew up eating white McDonald or McGavin's white bread, and I was just used to it, enjoyed it, and I had a very hard time changing over. And again, when we're doing our roasts or burgers, we want to try to use as many whole grains as possible. So the rice that we use, we want to use brown rice if possible. The only thing is, some of you may not be used to brown rice. Some of you may have family members who aren't used to brown rice. And so I say trick them. And the way to trick them is to make, like when I cook brown rice, I put it in a rice cooker. I usually cook 6 cups at a time. And I put 5 cups of brown and 1 cup of white in there. And so for my family that aren't used to brown rice, it looks like it has white in it, and it's easier for them to eat. Same with pasta and that. A lot of people aren't used to eating, the whole grain pastas and that, so I tell them to trick them again and put partial brown and the white ripe pasta together. It's better than all white, and it makes it people appreciate it. And those who aren't used to it, We don't want, remember what we said, we want to enjoy our food, we don't want to endure it. If you really like it all brown or whatever, fantastic. Another thing with brown rice is, have you ever noticed when it comes out of the pot, it's clumpy? You know, it's sticky, gooey, you know, it doesn't come apart nicely. And so I always try to make my rice ahead of time. And then I usually the day before, if possible. And then the next day, it'll crumple really, really easy. So when I'm making my fried rices or a Greek rice or whatever, you want it so it's separate. You don't want it to clump together. And it makes it a lot easier to work with. Rice will keep it in the fridge for about a week. Okay, so the recipe for cashew rice loaf, it, as Phil was saying, it's one of my favorite recipes, and it calls for the brown rice. This was frozen, and I have to honestly say I don't like rice that's frozen as much as that's just been refrigerated, but that's just my personal opinion. Then it calls for, just a sec, got the same thing here, just a second. It calls for breadcrumbs. When it calls for breadcrumbs, you want the breadcrumbs that are not dry, like zwieback. You want them fluffy and light because you don't want your bread, your cashew rice loaf to be heavy. You want it light and airy. And so I just take leftover bread and I blend it or use my Roboku or my food processor, blend it, and then I freeze that and have it on hand. So one part breadcrumbs, one part rice, and then the last part is the cashews. And here they are right here. And again, I do these three things right at the beginning, mixing them all together. I use my food processor for those, and if except for the rice, of course. But if you do that, it makes it nice and easy, and you can mix it all together just fine. When I use my breadcrumbs, I have to be honest, I don't like heavy-duty, you know, bread crumbs. I like it a little bit lighter. So when I make my own bread, which is usually half and half, I'll use that. And it makes a nicer finished product, in my opinion. Then it calls for onion. It gives it the flavor. It gives it the taste in your loaf. When I cut it up and I always saute it. Never, very, very seldom do I ever put an onion in a roast or anything that isn't sauteed. The reason why is I find onions very sharp and I want it to enhance it to give it the depth and the flavor, but I don't want it to be sharp and tingy and tangy. So I always saute my onions, and here they are right here. Just takes a few minutes, and you can do it however you want. I usually just do it in a little nonstick skillet with a little bit of olive oil, and it works just dandy. And I like that real, real well. So we mix this all together. That's the hard part. The very, very hard part. And then you want to have some flavor to it. And so what I use is calls for a little bit of celery salt, calls for a little bit of soy sauce, or you can use Bragg's amino acid. Again, I have to stress more than anything in my whole life is to know your seasonings. For example, soy sauce may be totally different than Bragg's. Bragg's doesn't have, to me, as much of a flavor as I like Kikkokum soy sauce, but some people don't. But it has a little bit more flavor. Whereas if you use China Lily or one of those stronger, whoa! If you put that much in as it calls for, it'll knock your socks off, and that's all you'll taste. And so know your seasoning and measure carefully. Okay, there you go. So, there's that, and knowing it, and remember what was the rule? You can always add, but you can't take away, right? Once you get it in there. Then it calls for some liquid to soften and moisten it. I usually use tofu milk. You can use whatever you so choose, but that's what I like to use. So I've made that here and pour it in. and mixer up, and that's my cashew rice loaf. Pretty easy. I think it calls for parsley too, doesn't it? You didn't put the recipe up on the board. You want it kind of mushy. I mean, not like you dripping mushy, but pretty mushy, like so. A little bit mushier than sticky. Okay, so first thing I do is I smell it. Smells like porridge. So I throw in a little more. There you go. Stir up again. Oh, these things of me, this thing back here is... Okay, there you go. Oh, pretty soon my pants are down to the floor. Quite a trick, huh? Okay, for the next act. Okay, here. Measuring carefully again. Okay, here we go again. Yep, that's better. Now it's on my nose. Okay. Now, when I make this roast, I usually put it in a bundt pan because it looks so pretty. And remember, even if you're one person, you want things to look nice. If it looks nice, you're going to enjoy it more. And even when Phil goes away, I set my things all pretty. I had an aunt that I absolutely loved. I called her Ma. And she served me peanut butter toast in the morning on a crystal plate. And I had a little crystal goblet with orange juice in it. I just felt like a princess. And all I ate was a peanut butter toast. Hey, so remember, it's really important what things look like. So anyways, a bundt pan, you put about 3 recipes that's in the cookbook, and it'll make it really pretty. Now, my bundt pan's been around forever, and it sticks sometimes. So I get some parchment paper, and I stick it all around it, like... and stick it in there, and I bake it, and just a few minutes before I want to serve it, I take it out, let it sit for a bit, flip it over, and oh, it's so pretty. You could decorate it with cranberry sauce and parsley or rosemary or whatever you want, and it is so wonderful. Makes excellent sandwich spread after. You could also replace the cashews with walnuts, and instead of... in the old green cookbook, this walnut rice loaf is in there. You can use walnuts instead of cashews. Instead of the tofu milk, you use a cashew cream or your basic cream sauce. And then I stick it in one of these little guys. And have you ever seen those papers in town now? They're the parchment papers. What do you call them? Cupcake papers. You ever seen those, the parchment ones? And they guarantee they don't stick. Well, they fit in these things just perfect. I love it. Because the fruit, before that, I was sticking these little papers in, cutting it. But now I just throw one of those parchment papers in here, and I throw this in here like so. And some of them I have like that 4 together. Those are easier. But here you put this in, fill it up. You can use it with cashew rice loaf too if you choose, but I do this with my walnut roast. And then let it cook, let it sit for a minute before I turn it over. I turn it over, and then I saute peppers and I put it on top. And, oh, I've got all these little loaves all on a platter with the little peppers on top. Oh, it looks so good. Sprinkle a little parsley. Oh, you guys, it's a feast fit for a thing.
The guests love it. I can tell you, yeah. They just love it.
It's really, really, really good. Now, when you're making patties or burgers, it's kind of the same thing, right? Except if you tried to make a burger out of this, there's nothing really to stick it together. So what are you going to do? We have some excellent walnut burgers. We've got the one Phil likes, the walnut rice burger, and I like the... apricot walnut burger because it's kind of sweet and sour, and you know me, I like the sweet things, right? And so I really like that. It's got some Dijon mustard in it, and oh, I just really like that one. Phil likes the other one, which is more meatier, you know, da da da. And guests like both of them, so there you go. But what I do for that is I stick, oh, it's kind of about the same thing, but with walnuts in it. You put oats in it because It will absorb the moisture and stick together better. You can put some garbanzo flour in it to make it stick together better, and it makes a really nice burger. The thing when you're making burgers in that, you know, usually if you're eating lacto-vegetarian, you'd put an egg in there so it would stick together. But we don't have the egg, and so what I usually suggest for people to do is let it sit overnight, because then your breadcrumbs are going to absorb that moisture, the oats are going to absorb that moisture, and it's going to be a lot easier to form. Again, remember, you're probably like me and you don't measure as carefully. If you're not, then remember, add and taste until you get what you like. You can always add, but you can't take away. When I've sat my burgers overnight, they'll be much firmer, much easier to work with. And I use a wide mouth ring with a patty paper that you can buy. And I get a one of these things. Thank you, ice cream scoop. And I put in one of those. I get another one, pat it down, and there, and I've got uniform burgers, okay? I can freeze these at this time, so when I go to town, I'm in a hurry, I can take them out and then use them, and I can have a lunch real quick. So it really makes it handy. It makes it uniform. And you know, when you're making burgers, you really want to make sure that, what do you want to make sure?
You want to make sure that you don't make them too thick.
Thank you. You keep going.
If you make, you have to think, if a person is making ground round, they're using a beef burger, then when they put it in the frying pan, 50% of the calories in that beef burger are fat. And so it's going to cook it right through. The heat is going to be carried right through the burger. Now I've got walnuts and oats and, you know, some grains and stuff like that, and I put it in there, and I want to make a burger as thick as I saw the one that the guy that had did a beef burger. The only thing is that there's no fat to carry the heat through it, so I get something that's cooked on the top, cooked on the bottom, and thick and uncooked in the middle. So you're much better off to make them thinner, and then you cook them more thoroughly. And if you like to have that sense of having more burger in your hamburger, then put two of them. But make sure that you cook them thoroughly. Otherwise, it spoils it. When we go out, we all order veggie burgers from different restaurants, and everyone's giving a shot at it now, and some of them are unfortunately just that. They're giving a shot at it, and they didn't quite make it. It was too thick, it was gooey, it was gummy, it wasn't well cooked, and it's really spoiled it. So when you're making them, make them a little thinner. When you brown them on both sides, they'll be cooked right through. Okay? Now, Eileen is going to have 5 minutes right now, because otherwise she's going to rob my Spanakopita thing. So she's going to talk to you about meal planning.
Can I ask you who talked all morning?
Huh? Okay. I slept well. No, I'm just kidding.
Breathing deeply. I'm breathing deeply, and I'm speaking quickly. Okay, here we go. What?
Okay, that's the slide. Just put up for both burgers.
Thank you. The slide. Okay. When have you ever gotten up in the morning or the middle of the night at 3 o'clock when Phil was talking about a few minutes ago, what am I going to have for lunch? I could have this. Oh, no, I don't have any of that. I could have that. No, I don't have any of that. What am I going to have? Have you ever done that? Do you know most of us rotate our meals around 10 or 11 things? But, you know, sometimes we just don't know what to have. That's where I gave you all one of these, and tomorrow when you come back, I'm going to ask you if you filled it out. You'll get 50% if you fill it out, okay? And so you got 50% from Phil, 50% from me, and you get a sticker. Wow, hey? Okay, so here we go. We've got these meal planners. Remember, you can always change it, but if you don't have it, you can't take away, right? You can't figure something else out. Usually I rotate it around different dishes. Phil thinks he's Italian. He isn't really, but he thinks he is. So if he had a choice, he'd have pasta every day. Would that be good? No. And so I try to switch my menus into one of those categories: legumes, loaves and burgers, pastas, rice dishes, soups and sandwiches, and I rotate it. And some of the favorites I might do too. Maybe one or two of them I might have leftovers, okay? And so that's what I try to fill in my little blanks with. Or I might change it to the ethnic groups, Chinese, Russia, Hungarian, Greek, Western, Mexican. Oh, lots of fun. Oh, man, there's so many things to have right now, isn't it? Sky's the limit. It's so much fun to cook. But anyways, I will fill this out, and then I'll look, and I'll say, I need rice on Monday, and I need it on Thursday, and a little bit on Sabbath. Okay, what am I going to do? If I cook a big pot in the beginning of the week, especially if it's whole grain and it takes an hour, how much time am I going to save? Lots. I'm going to save lots of time because I've got stuff on hand. How many of you have gone to the store, you found something, and on sale, brought it home, put it in the fridge, a week later you threw it out because you didn't need it? Anybody ever done that? I'm sure none of you have, but I used to do it quite often. I also live far away from town, so like I said before, I can't run to town and just buy everything. So I'm going to make this great, wonderful thing, and then all of a sudden I discover, oh, I had that one missing ingredient. So now I have to think all over again. You can always change your menu, but if you don't have it, it's a really chore. I'm like a little locomotive. Once I get going, I'm really going, and during the week I just can really start going, and all of a sudden I think, oh, well, I'm going to have chili. It's even better if two or three days if it sits. So I can do that on Monday because I have lots of time on Monday. And so here we go. So all of a sudden my whole week is just a chugging, and it makes it a lot easier. Try it, you guys. You'll never regret having a menu. Okay, Phil, you can do your spanakopita.
Thank you very much, Eileen. One item to add to what Eileen is saying, when you do produce a menu, you tend to make more variety. And that's really important to try and spread out the types of foods that you're eating so you have more variety. Michael Pullen, who studied nutrition around the world, said that we as human beings eat largely four foods. We eat the products from these four foods: rice, corn, soy, and wheat. The whole world is being fed largely from those four foods. If we can broaden where we get our calories from, if we can broaden out where we add more varieties of plants to our diet, we get more nutrients, we get a wider base of nutrients for our body to work from. He said we are eating in our world largely rice, corn, wheat, and soy. And so what we should do is try and just broaden it out. And menu sheet will help you to do that because you'll plan it more, you'll think more. And you'll start, when you go shopping, you'll say, I need some of this, I'd like to try some of that. And you'll start making a wider menu. What I'm going to show you right now is called spanakopita. A spanakopita we serve with our Greek meal. We will serve it with rice, with lemon, potatoes, with tzatziki, and a Greek salad. So the people have a wide variety of, it's like a Greek meal that we serve. And what we're going to use for that is we're going to use spinach. It's another word for spanakopita is spinach pie. And that's basically what it is, but it's spinach is the base of it. What Eileen usually uses is frozen spinach. At this time of year, when you get fresh spinach, you could steam the spinach. But either way, if you freeze it or steam it, you don't want to take it and use it as you thaw it out or as you steam it. You want to wring the water out of it. So after you've got it to the place where it's ready, then squeeze it and squeeze the water out of it. You do not want your spanakopita to be sloppy and gooey and the phyllo pastry to be gummy. So wring the water out. When you think you've got all the water out, then wring it out some more. In other words, make it dry. Eileen says this is the hardest part of making spanakopita is wringing the spinach out, okay? Then we add to the spanakopita, we're going to use for flavor, some roasted garlic. And the way we roast garlic is we take a bulb of garlic, cut the top off of it, so you expose the little toes, dribble some olive oil on the top, sprinkle a bit of salt on it, wrap it in tin foil, put it in the oven at 350 or 400, 300, 350 for 45 minutes. Take it out. The toes, the little cloves themselves, should be soft. You should be able to squeeze them out. At that point, don't let your husband near them because he'll probably squeeze them out and put them on toast and eat them. That's what I do. I love them just the way they are. Don't eat any butter. Just spread them on toast and eat them. They're absolutely delicious. Okay, now you've got roasted garlic, and we're going to put a bit of roasted garlic in there. We're going to grind up some feta cheese, soy feta cheese. We're going to grind it up or shred it up, and so we've got that. We're going to mix that together, okay? Now, there's a secret ingredient.
I forgot it.
And I mean forgot it. But she showed it. She showed it to you the other day, and that is the soy mayonnaise, that vegenaise she showed you. We have a lady that's a friend of ours. It's a Greek lady, and she told us the secret to Spanica pita is mayonnaise. She said you put the mayonnaise in at this point, and one tablespoon of mayonnaise or whatever is like that in this recipe makes it all that makes that soft. It just makes that Spanica pita rich and soft, and it makes it work. So okay, so we put that in, and then we're working with a product called phyllo. Now phyllo, you better do this because I got to hold this thing. Phyllo, you can buy it in the cooler section in your
frozen
grocery store.
Frozen.
And we can use it for a number of things. We make samosas out of it. We make this, and you can also make desserts out of it as well. But the two main things we make are samosas and the Spanica pita. And what you do, you have to keep it covered. As soon as you expose it to air, it dries out. It starts to crack. It falls apart. Makes a big mess. And there's all kinds of problems that are created in the kitchen between you and your wife. So anyway, what we do is Eileen is now stroking just a tiny bit of olive oil on it. We fold it in half and cut it into five strips. And then we take a tablespoon of the mixture of spinach, mayonnaise, feta, and roasted garlic with a pinch of cayenne in it. We take it and we put it on one of those strips, and Eileen is going to show you. We fold it like a flag. So you just keep on folding it until you've got this triangle, which is your Spanica pita. So she's going to do that now for you. I'll hold it. There you go. So she's folded it one way.
The most important part is to get the first part. You make it, whoa, the water slide here, on half, making this, is that perpendicular?
Even.
Even.
Good.
I thought I had a big word.
Oh, you do.
Okay, here. Over and over and down and over.
See that?
And then you
give
got
her
this.
A hand. Was that fantastic? Give her a hand. That's it. Good going. Okay. Now, then she brushes a little bit on that. You can put them now on a tray 15 minutes at 350 degrees. They're cooked. At how much?
375.
375, sorry. 375. Not 350, 375. 15 minutes, they're cooked. Now, if you decided that you wanted to make these ahead of time, you can freeze them. If you do freeze them, and you put them on your cookie sheets, put them out of the freezer, on the cookie sheets, and into the oven. Don't let them thaw out. If you let them thaw out, they'll go mushy. So you cook them right out of the freezer, and they'll work fine that way.
You can make the filling the day before, the morning before,
sure,
whatever.
You can make it earlier.
And that makes it easier if you do that.
Yeah. And they're quite quick. We did a cooking school at Red Deer where we had, I think it was 60 people, and we made them two each. So I made 120 of them on the morning in preparation for the cooking school. And that's not, you can do it. I mean, it's not that hard. Then we serve that with tzatziki sauce, which is really, for those of you who know, it's that shredded cucumber, sour soy cream, and something else.
Dill.
And you put that over top of them, and you've got fantastic, delicious Spanica pita. Okay? So that's
and
just some of the recipes that you can use.
Sorry about the mayonnaise, but that's a key thing because it sticks it together. Most Spanica pitas have egg in it, and that binds it and gives it that kind of sharp, sour, kind of lemony taste. Yeah. Excellent. Oh, yes, excellent.
Okay, so what are we going to talk about tomorrow, Eileen? She doesn't know.
Oh, quick meals.
Quick meals. We're going to talk to you about quick
meals.
So
much fun.
Okay, so let's bow our heads and have a word of prayer here this morning. Father in heaven, again, we want to thank you for the way you've created us. Lord, I personally want to thank you for what deep breathing has done for me. I just ask you, Lord, that you'll be with each person in this room, that as we seek to learn how to care for our health, that you'll teach us, that you'll encourage us, that you'll help us and remind us the value of these very simple things, these very important things, how to care for our health with deep breathing. Pray for anyone in this room that's suffering, that has pain. Lord, just teach them the value of deep breathing through that pain. Just thank you so much for it. Thank you for the things you've taught us with cooking, and we ask that you'll bless each home as they practice and as they seek to learn new recipes. We just ask that you'll inspire them and give them that encouragement you've given to us, and thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.